We're talking about secured credit cards here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Secured credit cards are used mainly by people who don't have much of a credit history or who have low credit scores. And according to FICO, the credit score people, there are about 53 million Americans who fall in this category, that they have no credit history. Have you used a secured credit card? What did you think about it? Are you someone with little or no credit? What questions do you have about building your credit worthiness? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Peggy Olive is a financial capability specialist at the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Peggy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Kate.
So we learned Amazon's new secured credit card is called the Amazon Credit Builder. Help us understand, what is a secured credit card?
Well, secured credit cards have been around for a few decades, and I guess the good news on that end is they've gotten a little better over that time. And so basically with a secured credit card, an individual needs to have their own stash of money, typically maybe $100 to $500, and then they put that money in a savings account or some kind of financial account that's linked to that credit card. And then their amount of savings becomes their credit limit on that credit card. So, for example, if they put $500 into that account, they have a $500 credit limit, and they could charge up to that amount on their secured credit card, although it's not a good idea for, you know, getting that close to your credit limit.
So basically then, if you try to make purchases over that limit, the card won't work?
That's right. So it won't work. You could be rejected. And also, if you miss a payment, it's called secured because the financial institution or the secured credit card company will take your payment right out of your linked savings account. So it has kind of that safety net for the credit card company if somebody, you know, starts going over the limit or not paying their bill or not keeping up with those payments.
So how would it differ then from a debit card?
Well, a debit card is using your own money. You're correct with that. But when you use a debit card, it doesn't do anything to build up your credit. It's not reported to any of the major credit bureaus. And that is something you do want to make sure if you are interested in getting a secured credit card. Most report to the major credit bureaus, but not all. And it doesn't do any good building up your credit if it's not appearing, your on-time payments are not appearing on your credit report. So, for example, with a debit card or a checking account or a prepaid credit card where you're using your own money, those are not reported to the credit bureaus.
So who would be a good candidate for one of these secured credit cards?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, it could be somebody who has no credit history, maybe a young person or just starting out, or a lower credit score. So they want to work on building up that, you know, establishing that positive on-time credit payments. And, you know, it's not for everyone, though, because you still have to come up with that savings amount that you won't be able to touch for maybe that year or the 2 years until that secured credit card ideally rolls over into a regular unsecured credit card, and then you can have access to your money again.
So this
so you
is
do have to have the savings.
Yeah, this is like a stepping stone then to a regular credit card.
Yes, absolutely. Many are set up that way, and that's another thing you want to check if you're shopping around for a secured credit card. Does it roll over into an unsecured credit card? You know, that might happen after 1 year, 18 months, 2 years. You know, and that's a way for the credit card company to also establish that relationship. They get to know you as a reliable customer, and then you might have the brand loyalty, and you might stick with their card. So then they want to roll you over into a non-secured card, and you get your money back, your deposit back.
We're learning about secured credit cards with Peggy Olive. She's a financial capability specialist at the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Do you have a low credit score? Is it something you're concerned about? What strategies have worked best for building or rebuilding your credit? And what would you recommend to others in that situation? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Peggy, with these secured cards, do rates and fees differ from one card provider to the next?
Yes, that is a good thing to look for when you're shopping around. There are some secured credit cards that have no annual fee or a low annual fee, and then there are some cards that have a higher, maybe $35 or $50 annual fee. So obviously you want to look for the lowest annual fee. And then also a secured credit card typically has a higher interest rate than a non-secured credit card. But really the idea is you're trying to build up your credit. So you want to keep whatever you charge on a secured credit card low, and then you want to pay it off in full on time every month. So the interest rate shouldn't be a factor if you're paying off the whole balance every month.
And you mentioned that secured cards often require a cash deposit. Can that deter low-income families from trying to build credit? And you also have to have a bank. So many families are unbanked.
Yes, absolutely. You have to have some way to save up the amount of money. For some secured credit cards, it could be $50 or $100. So that is something at least could make it a little bit more in reach. And also the secured credit card would have their own financial account. So if you got a secured credit card through your bank or credit union, you would deposit the money with them. But other secured cards have other financial accounts, so you wouldn't necessarily have to use your own bank account.
Have you seen any other retailers besides Amazon offer these types of cards in the past?
Nothing like what Amazon has rolled out, nothing that I've seen. I mean, there are the major credit cards. You can think about Citibank, Capital One, all of those major cards that do have some version of themselves, as do financial institutions. But I haven't run across anything that's been linked like the Amazon one with their perks that they have attached to that, too.
Well, let's talk about some other ways to build credit. If a secured credit card isn't a good fit for someone, what are some other options you would recommend for building your credit worthiness?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, you know, it's even worth checking around to see if you can get a non-secured card before you would get a secured card. So sometimes retail store cards, like a gas station card or department store, it's a little bit easier to get a credit card through a local business, and usually the credit limit is a little bit smaller. So that could be a easier start than trying to get a major, you know, MasterCard, Visa, Discover. So that would be one thing to look into before you even go the secured route. And then also, you know, for people who have a financial institution or are interested in establishing a relationship with a local bank or credit union, there's an option called a credit builder loan, where a financial institution would lend an individual, maybe it's a $300 loan, and that loan goes right into a savings account with that financial institution, and that person makes monthly payments to pay back that loan. And they don't have to come up with the $300 all at the same time like they would with a secured credit card, but they still would have to have a way of making those payments on the loan. And then after 6 months, or when the loan is all paid up to that limit, that $300, then it's reported on their credit report, and they get to keep that $300. So it's also kind of a forced savings account.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's another option to look into.
We're talking about secured credit cards, building credit with Peggy Olive. She's with the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Do you have low credit? Is it something you're concerned about? What strategies have worked best for building or rebuilding your credit? What would you recommend to others in the situation? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at secured credit cards and building your credit worthiness. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Amazon recently started a program for shoppers with no credit or bad credit. They would otherwise be disqualified from Amazon's loyalty cards. Secured cards are a connection to a really big segment of our population. According to FDIC, a quarter of U.S. households are either unbanked or underbanked. Have you declared bankruptcy? How did the lack of credit affect you after that experience? What questions do you have about the whole variety of credit cards available out there? Have you used retail or airline cards? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peggy Olive is a financial capability specialist at the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security, and she stays with us. Peggy, strategies for rebuilding credit are a bit different than just building credit in general. Can you help us break down what is the difference there?
Oh, sure. There might be some options available to people who have what we call a thin credit file, where they don't have a lot of credit history. You know, maybe they've just turned 18, or maybe they're just newly residents in this country. So they don't have a lot of credit history, but they don't necessarily have any negative credit history. Versus, you mentioned if somebody has declared bankruptcy and they would have a credit report which would have negative items in their file, which would really bring their credit score down. So for somebody who is just starting out, you know, they might be able to get a small retail store card, a credit builder loan, or perhaps a secured credit card. For somebody who has a negative history, they're kind of having to prove themselves over again if they're interested in rebuilding their credit, kind of starting over. So for somebody who, for example, if they're rebuilding their credit history from having some negative events, whatever bills they're currently paying, maybe they've reobligated a mortgage or a car loan, or usually credit cards are closed. But if they have utilities or a rent payment, they can work on paying all of those bills on time every single month. And those, you know, their utilities may not necessarily report to the credit bureaus unless it's a really large utility or landlord. But if they miss a payment, that definitely is reported, could be going to collections and show up as a negative event. So just establishing on-time payments and having that habit and keeping up with your current bills starts giving you some good track record of at least keeping up with paying those bills.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Heather is joining us from Madison. Hi, Heather. What's your question?
Good morning. Thank you for having this topic. I am calling because I had someone in casual conversation a while ago mention something about a virtual credit card number, and I've never heard of it before. I didn't get a chance to ask much for questions. To me, it kind of sounds like it would be a firewall between the world and your real credit card numbers. I was curious if you knew anything about it, when it's appropriate to be used.
Yeah, Heather, so virtual credit cards. Peggy, what do we know about that?
Not much on my end. That's not a term. I guess I'm not sure how the person was using that, you know, if they were using it as a firewall, but it's also linked to some other credit card or a banking account.
Yeah, apparently some credit issuers, you can get a unique virtual credit card number that links to your main credit card account, and using a virtual credit card may help protect you against fraud when you shop online or by phone. So that might be a feature, perhaps, of some card issuers.
That certainly could be, like you said, kind of a feature, a safety net. I mean, we've had cards convert to the chip cards, which you get a one-time usage authorization number every time you use the chip card. So they're certainly trying to build in other authentication factors.
Yeah, how safe are credit cards these days? How often do they get breached?
Well, unfortunately, you know, every few months you turn on the news and you hear something that a credit card holder or a credit bureau or could be another business did get breached or the information was stolen. But really, there are a lot of precautions and consumer safety nets in place in terms of if someone just accesses your credit information, that you're not responsible for those charges, to contact your credit card company. And that's why it's so important to keep track of and keep an eye on your credit statements if you have a credit card, to just look for any charges you didn't make and then contact the company immediately, so they can, you know, fix it up, cancel it, get your new card, whatever it might be.
We're talking about building credit with Peggy Olive. She's a financial capability specialist at the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. With your questions along the way, what questions do you have about the variety of credit cards available? Have you used retail or airline cards? Join in at 800-642-1234. Peggy, how can student loans affect a young person's credit? These loans can, you know, be a significant amount of money for borrowers with thin or no credit. So what is that credit score relationship?
Well, sure. Student loans can be a young person's first credit that's been reported to the credit bureaus if they don't have a credit card or landlord or utility reported yet. And once they graduate and start making those payments, that can really start to help build up a positive credit history. So making those on-time payments and just, you know, plugging away at that. If they miss a payment, unfortunately, that lowers anyone's, you know, credit score. So they want to keep working on paying those amounts and keeping up with that. And then it could help them to build their other credit. Once they start having a positive track record of paying back student loans, then they could look for, you know, other credit cards or retail store cards that would start adding to that positive history.
So pay on time, pay at least slightly more than the minimum. What are some other tips for paying back large loans like a student loan or a mortgage?
Sure. Well, just like you mentioned, you want to keep up with those payments, pay on time, just to establish that regular history. I think it gets a little bit more challenging when you have something like a credit card, whether it's secured or not. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. When you have a credit limit, let's say it's a $1,000 credit limit, people think, okay, great, I can charge up to $1,000 and I'm paying, you know, my monthly payment on time. But anytime you use more than about 25% of a credit limit on a credit card, it's going to lower your credit score. And with some credit models, such as the FICO, they wouldn't want you to use any more than 5% of your credit limit if you're interested in boosting your credit score. So really, I mean, the credit card is there for convenience, but you really want to watch how much you're charging on that.
Even if you're paying it off fully at the end of a cycle, end of the month?
Yes, even if you're doing that. Because when they're pulling your credit score, it might be right, you know, the day before you make your payment. So it could look like your balance is very high.
Peggy, there are so many card options out there. There are airline cards. There are cards where you get certain incentives to use businesses. How do you go about looking at the rewards and figuring out which rewards are best?
You're right. You just get online and you can search through all those. And just knowing that there's many websites out there that they get a kickback or an incentive for promoting that card. You know, there's trusted sites, perhaps going to Consumer Reports and checking out their ratings, or the Better Business Bureau checking out ratings of certain credit cards or the institutions. But definitely shopping around, comparing, looking at, you know, not to promote any particular sites, but there's for bankrate.com is one of probably the most popular ones, credit.com, NerdWallet. So there's tons of sites out there, or Consumer Reports where you have a unbiased information. And I do want to say, I mean, they're always coming out with new products, new ideas, and there is another option that was just launched a few months ago by Experian, the credit reporting bureau, that has an Experian Boost product, where people can choose to have their financial institution, their banking checking account, attached to their Experian credit report, where if they pay their utilities on time, their cell phone on time, that will show up in their credit report because they can look at that on-time payment through your checking account information. So that's another way. It's a brand new model, just came out a few months ago. But, you know, there's pros and cons. So that's assuming you're okay with linking your credit card to your bank statement. That assumes that the lender is going to be using FICO 8 score through Experian. But it's also another option for people to check out.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, absolutely. There's always exciting things happening in the world of credit.
Peggy Olive is a financial capability specialist at the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Join us Thursday for a midsummer celebration featuring music, storytelling, and comedy from the shores of the Mississippi River. We celebrate the holiday with laughs and music from guests, including Twin Cities comedian Amber Preston, Northern Wisconsin cellist Ed Willett, River Falls poet Thomas Smith, and a trio from La Crosse. It is the Big River Radio Wave Independence Day special. That is Thursday, July 4th at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, back by popular demand, we're talking about ticks and Lyme disease. Have you ever received Lyme disease from a tick? What did doctors recommend you do? How do you protect yourself now? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back with how to protect yourself from ticks and Lyme disease after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ticks and Lyme disease as we head into the great outdoors this holiday week. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We learned about new research on ticks a couple months ago, and we just couldn't fit in all the great questions and stories. So here's your second chance. What burning questions do you have about ticks? Have you been bitten by one recently? Are you noticing more ticks in your area? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lyric Bartholomew studies infectious disease agents in parasites. She is a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences here at UW-Madison. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So we've got a lot of tourists who are driving north this week for the holiday break. How much of a difference is there between ticks you see in southern Wisconsin versus the ones in the northern region?
Yeah, the ticks that we see in Wisconsin that are most important in thinking about Lyme disease are really all over the state. There may be more of them up north, but we certainly see them down here in Wisconsin, or down in southern Wisconsin, too.
So basically, they are spread all over the state, no matter where you go?
That's right.
So are there, what can you tell us about the Lone Star tick, which was spotted in northern Wisconsin last week?
Yeah, the Lone Star tick is a really interesting and annoying tick. It's one that actually is really pretty aggressive. It actually will chase you down and find a host. So really interesting behavior. It's also a tick that we see moving progressively northward in the United States. So I used to work in Iowa, and during the 10 years that I was in Iowa, when I landed there, the Lone Star tick was probably in the lower third of the state. And by the time I finished there and was moving to Wisconsin, it was really probably two-thirds of the way up the state, really established. So it's progressively invading further and further northward. In Wisconsin, we're just seeing it really periodically. And so there was this sighting of that tick recently here, and there have been a handful of those in previous years as well. But it doesn't seem like it's probably established yet. But a good thing to keep an eye out for.
What does it look like?
It's a really distinct tick. The females, anyway, have a sort of distinct white dot on the back, on the shield, on the back of the body. Otherwise, brownish with a dot.
Brownish with a dot. So is this a tick from Texas? You know, why is it called the Lone Star tick?
Yeah, I think that name is related to the bright white spot.
Mm-hmm. Bites from the Lone Star tick can cause lifelong allergic reactions to red meat. Is that true?
Well, this is something that we're starting to see more and more is reports of this red meat allergy. At this point, it looks like it's really a strong correlation, but we still have quite a bit of research to do to really understand it. It seems like there are things in the saliva or spit of that tick that could be allergenic and cause that kind of response. But right now it's correlation And we're continuing to monitor that.
Sounds like you need to gather up a whole lot more Lone Star ticks to do lots more research.
That's right. And I don't know that anybody really wants to sign up to be part of that research.
We're talking with Lyric Bartholomew. She's a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. She joins us as we talk about ticks and how to protect against diseases they carry. What questions do you have about ticks or mosquitoes, for that matter? Have you noticed more in your neighborhood or in your favorite park? What have you done to protect yourself? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lyric, how can people protect themselves from ticks? Are there effective bug sprays? How do we do it?
Yeah, it's an important question and one that we get a lot. There are a variety of really good preventative measures. So some things that people can do are to purchase a bug spray or repellent that has DEET or several other active ingredients in it. And I really like the EPA website for making decisions about tick and mosquito repellents. There's a really nice interface where you can use drop-down menus and sort of choose the best repellent for you based on how long you're going to be outside and what kind of activities you'll be doing. And it even gets you to brand name and particular products. So I recommend that. We also see that the pyrethroid-treated clothing, so you can buy treated clothing that's repellent and also would kill ticks. So that's a good preventive measure. And if you don't want to spend the money on the already treated clothing, you can actually treat it yourself. You can buy the product and treat your own clothing that way. We also recommend that people wear long pants and long sleeve shirts and ideally something that's sort of lighter in color so that if a tick were on you, you would detect it more readily. You'd see that contrast. And it's also wise to prevent ticks from crawling up your legs by sort of cuffing your pants like we did in the 80s and then pulling your socks over them.
Nice look.
Right. It's not super fashionable, but it's wise. Or we see with our tick teams that are going around the state looking for ticks that it is useful to wear rubber boots. So it seems like that may be a way to prevent the ticks from ultimately getting on you. Maybe it's less of surface for the ticks to be able to cling to. So
for the clothing that's treated, what if when you wash that clothing, what happens?
Yeah, so it's impregnated. There's really great technology to impregnate these insecticides into fabrics. And so you can wash them really over and over and over again. And if you treat your clothing yourself, after you've washed it many times, you just treat again. It's the same sort of concept that we've used to develop the bed nets that are used to protect people from contracting malaria.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones now with Jane joining us from Suamico. Hi, Jane.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to call in because my husband has had two bouts of tick-borne illness that I think are worth talking about. He's in the middle of it right now, and it starts with a bite, and I pulled out a female deer tick, so we know what it was. It began with a hard BB-sized black spot, and within 3 days had grown to an inch and a half with redness all around that area. And then within a matter of a couple of weeks, it moves redness over 18 inches of area and around a 6-inch area around the bite itself. It becomes a blistering mass.
Wow.
Where the blisters burst and a yellow clear liquid comes out, and it's hundreds of blisters. It's just terrifying to watch how it changes so rapidly.
And Jane, he's receiving medical treatment for this.
Right, and they tried doxycycline, but that doesn't do it. And he's on amoxiclav, which is a kind of Augmentin, from what we understand, as well as surface antibacterial mupirocin right now. And that seems to knock it back, but he missed one dose and oh my God, it started all over again. So
wow.
It's just terrifying.
Jane, thank you so much for walking through what could happen. Lyric, that's really scary.
It's really scary, and I commend you, Jane, and your husband for keeping such a close eye on this and actually finding the tick and watching those symptoms, unfortunately, unfold. And good for you for getting intervention as quickly as you could. So this is the reality. It's something that so important to look for ticks and get them off of you as quickly as you can, because we know that a tick has to be attached for some time in order to transmit the bacteria. The sooner you can get the tick off and watch for those signs and symptoms, the better. And if you actually see if you're one of those people that's lucky enough to see what we call the bullseye rash and get intervention, then hopefully with all the work that you're doing, that'll resolve for him.
What does the bullseye rash look like?
It's really so much like Jane described it. That was really an excellent depiction in my mind of what it looks like. Oftentimes it looks like a really deep, dark bruise at the site of the actual bite. And then over time, a red rash radiates out from that. And it can get quite large. As Jane mentioned, it can get even sort of like a foot in diameter or so. And it can be accompanied by things like a headache and a stiff neck, sometimes even arthritis-like symptoms. So really, really distressing and devastating.
So after going on a hike or being outside, where on your body should you be checking for ticks?
Yes, there are some places that that ticks tend to go to. If you're just coming in from a hike or time outside, and you're looking for ticks, they'll likely be on the lower part of your body. But it would be, I'd be remiss in advising you to don't only look at the lower part of your body, right? And sometimes, frankly, it helps to have a friend to help you look, because they can be in places that you can't see. Some people find them more readily sort of around their hairlines. Ticks may like sort of warm spaces and cozy places to go and feed. So that's a good place to look too. One thing that we recommend is that if you are coming in after being outdoors and you know you're in a heavy tick area, that you shower within just a couple hours of having been outside. And so that may help you wash the tick off if it hasn't already stuck its mouth parts into your skin. Or it could help you detect it more readily just because you've physically taken off all of your clothing and you have better access to seeing all of your skin surfaces.
We're learning about Lyme disease and ticks and how to stay protected on our forest hikes, by the lake, and in our own backyard with Lyric Bartholomew. She's with us, a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. Have you received Lyme disease from a tick? How did it impact you? What did you learn from the experience? Are you now more cautious about going outside? Join in at 800-642-1234. And email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this with your questions in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. Back by popular demand, we're getting to all your questions on ticks and Lyme disease here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lyme disease is normally transmitted to humans from ticks, and the number of reported cases of Lyme disease has more than doubled in Wisconsin over the past decade. Last year, more than 3,000 people were infected. It's according to estimates by state health officials. Have you received Lyme disease from a tick? What was that experience like? Did you recognize and treat it right away? What did doctors recommend? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lyric Bartholomew is our guide. She is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in parasites. Let's go back to the phones now with Craig joining us from Madison. Hi, Craig.
Hi there.
What's your question about ticks?
Well, I was wondering, I like to go out and photograph insects and arachnids in the wild, and I was wondering if there's a safe alternative for them to using either repellents with pyrethroid repellent, so you're not damaging, I guess, unintended animals, basically, if that makes sense.
Sure. It's something that we all think about a lot. And when you're an entomologist, there are insects that you want to repel and then other insects that you want to have a chance to really look at and admire. Those sort of repellents that we've talked about are really most impactful, right, for those things that suck on blood. So the repellents work by either sort of masking your scents or blocking the receptors in the antennae, for example, of a mosquito, so that she can't find you. So I don't think that something like DEET would be something that would repel the other beetles and nicer things that you want to look at. But there are things like pyrethroids that are indeed insecticides and could kill other insects and arachnids too. So if you want to be out and recreating, then there are those alternatives. So, for example, you can tuck your socks into your pants or wear tall rubber boots as potential ways to protect yourself from ticks while still getting to enjoy the outdoors. And then also for sure doing those tick checks once you get home. And that way you could avoid the pesticides but still protect yourself from tick exposure.
Are there effective sprays that use natural ingredients like lemon eucalyptus oil?
There is.
Yep. Vinegar?
There are, yeah, right. There are a variety of products out there and available. I would encourage you, again, to use the EPA website to look at products for which there's been really good data produced to look at the efficacy or efficiency of those products.
Let's go to Carol now, joining us from Racine County. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I had Lyme's disease a few years ago, and my doctor was not sure what would happen if I were to get bit again as far as being tested, because she thought the antibodies would stay, or whatever they would be called, would stay in my body, and I would test positive either way. So if I were to get bit again, how would I know if I actually had Lyme disease again?
Yeah, really, it's an important question. And it's something that we can find materials for you from an infectious disease doctor that would be even more explicit. But you certainly could get infected with Lyme again. It's one of those pathogens that doesn't cause what we call a sterile immunity. It makes it really hard to vaccinate for this pathogen too. So you can get bitten repeatedly and contract Lyme repeatedly. And if you're concerned about the diagnostic detection, you have to be really vigilant about making sure that you're watching for those signs and symptoms that a previous caller talked to us about. So you would still potentially see the bullseye rash and have signs and symptoms like a headache and, again, a stiff neck and potentially fever, et cetera, after exposure. So watching for ticks, doing tick checks, and then also watching for possible signs and symptoms will be important for you and for all of us, really.
Is it always the bullseye rash, or are there other signs and symptoms of Lyme disease that perhaps, you know, we are not watching for?
Yeah, it's an important question, because the bullseye rash shows up in probably 70 or 80% of people. And sometimes the rash may show up in places where you just don't see it, or it may not be very large. So it would be important to also be looking for, really just feeling like you have a bacterial infection, fever, headache, feeling lethargic and not well. And then also some people experience even more distressing things. Lyme disease can cause a facial palsy, so you can have a paralysis in the face. Some people have sort of cardiac manifestations of the illness too. So there can be a range of symptoms. Erythema migrans is the one that is most consistent, but you're right. It's not everyone sees it.
Let's go to Matt now in Madison. Hi, Matt.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I've had two tick-borne illnesses twice in my life, the first in 1999 and the second one in 2003. And in 1999, it was positively identified as Lyme's disease. And I noticed I was with the U.S. military in the infantry, and so we were in the woods a lot, and I didn't notice the tick. I didn't know I had been bitten, but I had a running program, and I just was, instead of making progress in my running program, I was losing progress, and I was really fatigued. And so I went to the doctor, and I said, hey, I think I have Lyme disease. And sure enough, but what was interesting about it is he put me on an antibiotic, and for the first 48 hours, it worked, the antibiotic did. But the illness actually rallied and overcame that first antibiotic. And so the doctor had to put me on a second antibiotic, and fortunately, the second one worked.
Mm. Wow.
So this is reminiscent of another caller's story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Matt, how do you feel today?
Oh, fine. I think we caught it again. We caught it early because I noticed it, but it was it actually had bitten me on my foot. And I had the rash on my foot, but I had new footwear, and I thought the new footwear had caused the rash, and I didn't, at the time I didn't realize it was from a tick bite, but in hindsight I realized that was the bullseye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you certainly
investigated, did that detective work, so important when you're in that situation. Matt, thank you so much for the call. Should you report being bitten to health authorities?
So we recommend that you watch for ticks, right? And then if you have a tick bite and it's indeed a black-legged tick, then and it's from an area where there's a lot of Lyme disease, then all of those pieces of information would be used by your physician to make a decision about treatment. I think Matt brings up some important points that are really valuable about watching for the tick exposure, and the ticks are really, really small. So one of the things that some of the people associated with our Center of Excellence here at UW are doing this summer is getting out and educating people about just how tiny the tick is. Most Lyme disease is passed on to people by the nymph stage tick, which is really like the size of the tip of the point of a pen or a freckle. And so you really have to, if you're, 40 or older, put on your reading glasses and look really quite carefully in order to find them.
Be very vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lyric, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in ticks, mosquitoes, and other parasites. And by the way, we'll have that EPA link on our morning show page at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.